This is All of It. I'm Kushan Avidar. Allison Stewart is out on medical leave. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. I'm grateful you're here. On today's show, we'll speak with the director of the new documentary series Unseen, which premieres on PBS tonight. We'll see what books The Atlantic included in its list of the great American novels. And spring is tomorrow, which means it's time to celebrate Nowruz, the Persian New Year. That's the plan, so let's get this started with how a positive outlook on life can actually make you happier. We often think there are two types of people. You're an optimist or you're a pessimist. A new book from psychiatrist Dr. Sue Varma presents a concept that she believes can dramatically improve how we feel in and engage with the world. She calls it practical optimism. In the face of all the stress, anxiety, and responsibilities that can come with navigating life in 2024, it makes sense if you're feeling kind of pessimistic. But practical optimism doesn't mean just putting a positive spin on things. Varma's model is a studied psychiatric set of principles and guidelines that can make us more self-confident, happier every day. Varma also points out that adapting this optimistic mindset takes work. It's a muscle. In her book, she includes techniques, actions, and tools to begin to adopt a more positive outlook, which she says is proven to benefit both our physical and our mental health. Sue Varma is now a private practice psychiatrist and a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at NYU Langone Health. After 9/11, she was also the first medical director at the World Trade Center Mental Health Program. Her book is called Practical Optimism: The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being, and she joins me now. Hi, Dr. Varma.
Hi, thank you so much for that lovely welcome.
Absolutely.
So excited to be here with you today.
Excited to have you. And listeners, we want to hear from you too. Do you consider yourself more of an optimist or a pessimist, and why? Call or text us now at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or you can reach us on social media. Our handle is at AllOfItWNYC. How does your natural optimism or pessimism affect your day-to-day? And if you think of yourself as an optimistic person, what do you notice about how your optimism helps your outlook on life? Or do you wish you were a little bit of, you know, one or the other? We're here for all of it. Call us, text us, 212-433-9692. Okay, Dr. Varma, I first thought that your distinction between optimism and practical optimism was pretty interesting. Early on in the book, you say, quote, "Optimists may be born, but practical optimists are made." Please unpack that.
Yes. So, you know, it was very interesting that when I started my work with 9/11 survivors, I learned a lot about resilience. And when I went into the science of resilience, I learned a little bit about optimism, but not too much. And no one else really paid attention to it. Because it was this idea that you were either born with this glass half full thinking or not. And if you weren't, then you were kind of out of luck. I realized years later that yes, optimism is genetic, but only a small part of it, maybe 25% of it. And scientists did find a gene, the oxytocin receptor gene, that they think might be related to optimism. But what was so fascinating was that what these genes coded for were skills. And the reality is that all of us can learn skills, emotional regulation skills, coping skills, interpersonal skills. So then I got very invested and I said, you know, I'm already teaching my patients skills. And as someone who has been on both sides of the couch, who has gone through her own therapy, specifically cognitive behavioral therapy, and found it so helpful because it equipped me with real-time, actionable, tangible tools, I said, we really need to come up with a paradigm that not only helps us helping our patient with treatment, because the reality is only a small percentage of people will ever seek treatment in their life or even ever get diagnosed, but all of us could benefit from skills in prevention. And so practical optimism is, that's what it is. It helps for both prevention, for maintenance, can help as part of a treatment plan, but it differs from optimism in the sense that it's not blind. It's not extreme optimism. A lot of times people have what's called extreme optimism or something called the ostrich effect, where you bury your head in the sand and you say everything will work out. Sometimes people think equate optimism with woo-woo thinking and manifesting. And look, I'm not at all against manifesting, but it's got to be backed with science and it's got to be backed with action. And that's what practical optimism is. It's not just a mindset, it's a skill set, a tool set, and an action set.
So how does regular optimism compare to practical optimism in terms of what people often misunderstand about the impact that optimism can have in your life?
Yes. So when we think of optimism, the straight definition is simply having a positive outlook, but it doesn't tell you how to achieve it. And practical optimism says we can turn positive outlooks into positive outcomes through key steps. And I helped to codify what these 8 steps are, and I created them as pillars. And they start with having a purpose in life, whether it's the big P of purpose, a purpose in life or a purpose in an activity. And then it helps you translate that. You know, the last P pillar is practicing healthy habits. So you can really take anything. If you have an intention, it starts with having a plan, a vision, a goal, then it teaches you how to put it into action. And I think a lot of times people are waiting for something from the outside to motivate them. You know, I joke with my patients, you know, whatever you want, it's not going to fall from the ceiling, you know, into your lap in this session. You have to go out in the world and create it. And a lot of times toxic positivity is what we think of when we think of optimism, just telling someone, get over it, you know, just look on the positive side, just look on the bright side. And we know that telling someone in the midst of disappointment and grief and loss to just look on the bright side is not going to help. And so we need to create a space where we validate a person's emotions. And then we also teach them how to cope and how to move through it. And so I'm a big believer that, you know, my job as a physician isn't just to help someone go from dysfunction to function, but how to go from functional to optimal. And that's what the science of optimism shows us. Optimal living head to toe. Optimists experience exceptional longevity. They live 20% longer than the average person. They make more money. They're 40% more likely to have a promotion in the next year. They're 5 times less likely to have burnout, 6 times more likely to be engaged with work, less cardiac disease, less strokes, less headaches, less anxiety and depression. But if you're not born with it, which is what we think of with optimism, you don't have to be a naturally born or dispositional optimist. You can learn these skills and still benefit from them. That's what practical optimism is.
Can you go a little bit into the science behind all of those positive manifestations you just mentioned? How does this way of thinking actually affect the body?
Yes. So, you know, when we think, in pessimism, we see, and this is based on the work of Dr. Martin Seligman, who talks about, he was actually doing research in depression and pessimism and learned helplessness. And there are certain key features that pessimists have. They tend to take things personally. They tend to think that negative things are pervasive, and they think that they're permanent. And then I added a fourth P, is that they then become passive or feel paralyzed by it. And when you are engaging in rumination and pessimistic thinking, this is lighting up the sort of right side of the brain, the negative thinking. And over time, that you have less and less room to be pessimistic without you sliding into a depression. And when we do functional MRIs of the brain, we see that pessimistic thinking, rumination, looks like a person with depression over time. We know that over time, having chronic cortisol levels, which you see in pessimists, people who are, you know, sort of negative persistently, I'm not talking about feeling pessimistic in one aspect of their life. Because by the way, many of us can experience optimism in certain aspects of our life, job or romantic relationships, or our health, but may feel pessimistic in others. So it's not enough to say, just be an optimist. You also have to look at your negative thinking, because the negative thinking is what is causing elevated cortisol levels, elevated epinephrine and norepinephrine. And over time, we know that this is related to inflammation in the body, to hardening of our arteries, to getting, when you have hardening in your arteries, you're predisposing yourself to cardiac disease, small, what we call small vessel disease. And there's small vessels in our brain, there are vessels in our heart, there are vessels that go to our kidneys. So you really are affecting every single organ system with persistent negative thinking. And it's not just the negative thinking and the elevated cortisol levels that come with it, being in a chronic state of fight or flight. It's also that pessimists are less likely to engage in healthy behaviors, such as something as simple as wearing a seatbelt, going to annual screenings, following up with the doctor's visits, following up with treatment. Optimists are more likely to take care of their health, from dental health to mental health. So they're more likely to say, when the doctor goes, says, you know, your cholesterol is elevated, your heart rate is elevated, you have all these problems. The extreme optimist on one hand might say, I don't have a problem, doc. I don't know what you're talking about. The pessimist may say, you know, I'm not coming to see you. I don't like you. Or they would say, they would be so negative, they wouldn't even make the appointment. So it's the habits and it's the thinking and it's the inflammation and the elevated chronic cortisol, all that's working in concert to lead to poor health outcomes.
It sounds like optimists, a key distinction there that I hear you describing, and tell me if this is accurate. There's the sense of empowerment or the sense of like agency over actions leading to results. Do you think that's fair?
Absolutely. And thank you so much for phrasing it that way, because agency is actually one of the key pillars, and I call it proficiency. So, you know, this idea of self-efficacy is I can do, I am capable. And, you know, it's very interesting because self-efficacy, again, it's something that we can have in different aspects of our lives. So a person may say, I'm very good with managing emotions. That's called emotional self-efficacy. Another person may say, I'm very good with managing my finances, financial self-efficacy. Another person may say, I'm a really good, you know, homemaker. I feel like I have control. So we may experience control and agency over one aspect of our lives, but not in another one. And what practical optimism does, it says, in the very beginning, I ask people, let's get a snapshot of how you feel in each of these pillars. And proficiency is a huge one, because we realize it's not just your ability that predicts success, it's your confidence in those abilities. And we want to actually maximize both. I'm not a big believer of, okay, fake it till you make it. You actually need to do the work. You need to be it, not just fake it. So it's both, but both confidence in your abilities and the abilities are both equally important.
Sounds kind of like a muscle. You're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Sue Varma, who's a psychiatrist and clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at NYU Langone Health. And we're talking about optimism, but not optimism as you might think about it. We're talking about practical optimism. It's the subject of Dr. Varma's new book, Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being. And listeners, we're taking your calls. Do you consider yourself more of an optimist or a pessimist? If so, why? Call or text us now at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And Dr. Varma, we just got a text that is from another physician who writes, I'm a physician who worked through the COVID pandemic in New York City. I generally consider myself a practical or pragmatic optimist before the pandemic, but in the past 4 years, I found myself becoming much more pessimistic. I feel like I have completely changed in character. Where before the pandemic, I generally felt like the world was generally good and the future was hopeful. And now I am convinced of the opposite. The only people I know that are truly able to be optimistic all of the time, like my mother, for example, are people who are purposefully ignoring anything that doesn't align with their quote unquote toxic positivity, like saying your gratitudes. What is there to be grateful for here? So first of all, thank you very much for sending that text, listener. A lot to unpack here, Dr. Varma. Part of it is this sense of, I guess, not degradation, but this sense of slipping from one side into another, plus the sense of not being able to see what's in your environment around you. What did that elicit for you while you were listening?
Yeah. So first, I want to thank the physicians, all of them, my colleagues who served during this very trying time. And, you know, I can relate and I can understand how a person loses faith. And I think for different people, different life and different world circumstances have made us disillusioned, discouraged, disenchanted, upset, frustrated at the system, at the world. And that's an important part of practical optimism, is to be able to understand. And I perseverated when I wrote my author's note in the beginning, because I said, I never want to diminish or minimize a person's lived experience. And depending on which part of the world, depending on life circumstances, challenges, work that you do, it is very easy to lose faith, especially when things have not gone our way. And, you know, it's interesting that a recent survey had come out. The American Psychological Association puts out a survey every year, a Stress in America survey. And more recent surveys are showing higher stress levels across the population because of a key feature. They talk about, okay, everything that's going on in the world, war, inflation, climate change, the pandemic. And I'm definitely sensitive to the fact that this physician and many other physicians were going through very difficult times while they had their own anxieties, their own burnout, which we know healthcare workers had a very high amount of that. They were not, you know, many of them didn't feel protected, didn't feel heard. They had families at home. They had to worry about them. They were worrying about their own health. And they really had to put their own stuff aside and didn't have a safe space. So I have so much tremendous amount of respect and understanding and sensitivity around it. And what the survey showed is that with all that is happening in the world, the reason we're feeling more stressed than ever is all of these things have happened on some level, but maybe they're happening more. They're all happening at once. But the key feature is a sense of loss of control over our stressors. And when you were talking about agency, a really big part of agency is feeling as if you have control over what's going on in your life and in the world. And when there's a mismatch between what is happening or coming from the outside world being thrown at us and our ability to handle it, that is when you see a person start to have breakdown in their worldview. And one thing I always say is, and again, I can't diagnose, right? So I'm putting out a disclaimer. Our conversation is for educational or information or entertainment purposes, whatever you want to call it. But I always tell folks that when you feel, because I'm a psychiatrist and I work with folks who come to see me to say, I don't feel the same anymore. And one of the things we do is talk about, you know, could there be a depression in the picture? Because when we are feeling very like our pessimism is just there to stay, especially when there is a change in our behavior or our baseline as adults. You know what? Something that was very interesting to me that came out of our research on the pandemic is that it is very hard for adults' personalities to change. Most adults' personalities don't change. And if they do change over time, it's over at least a decade or more. And the pandemic saw the fastest amount of personality changes in a very short period of time. And there are very few traumas, because I do consider this a trauma. And when I think about my career, it sort of started out working with 9/11. And then 20 years later, we were hit with another massive tragedy and a loss of lives, especially with the heightened anxiety with New York City peak of death toll. And so I feel like a lot of people's personalities have changed. But as a psychiatrist who works with folks with depression and anxiety, I always say when the pessimism is there and it's lingering, you know, we have to consider burnout, but we also have to consider depression. That and speaking, and there's no harm in getting help and saying, look, I want to talk about this. I'm not the person that I used to be. So what can we do? And, you know, medication isn't the first thing that comes to my mind. There's a lot of other things. Cognitive behavioral therapy is very helpful and effective.
Which is something that you talk about in your book. Yeah. So let's hear from somebody who calls themselves a practical optimist. We have Sharon from Oakhurst, New Jersey. Hi, Sharon. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was listening to your show and I find it very interesting because I know people that that are my age that have a hard time looking at things in a different way, and I feel like they're stuck and that makes it harder for them to deal with stress. And I don't have that difficulty. I think I was born with it, but I also think that it's from living like over time because I'm 61 and I feel like it's also helped me to stay very healthy, like as I've gotten older, to be able to adjust, you know?
Yes. Sharon, thank you so much for that call. And Dr. Varma, it sounds like this is a perfect example of a person you're talking about where it can be a, something you're born with or learned over time. Do you work with a lot of people that fit this description where they are born with it and then they keep going, or is that kind of a diamond in the rough?
No, I mean, you know, definitely 25% of the population is born with this positive mindset. And sometimes you'll see people who will identify as optimists, and then maybe some tragedies happen in their life and then they feel that they have had a setback. And the beauty of optimists is that they get help often, and they say, you know what, I see that something is not working out, I have changed, and I need help, and that there's something I can do about it. And I think that is that sense of agency. Two things. One is something is figure outable. And number two, I'm going to get help to get it figured out. And that's really two important things. There's something called outcome expectations. And that has to do in this discussion of self-efficacy is not only do I have the ability to go and get the help. So let's say someone is struggling and they're trying to lose weight, for example, and that's just one example, or it could be struggling with a depression, but it's having the hope that things can get better and that if I get help, it can get better, because that takes a, you have to kind of connect the dots, right? Like one, you have to identify that there's a problem that needs fixing, right? That it doesn't have to be this way. And I think sometimes in pessimism, we get so mired in negativity that we forget that there is a way out. We forget that there could be an alternative.
Let's pause there. I'm talking to Dr. Sue Varma about practical optimism and her new book on the topic. Listeners, we love getting your calls and texts. When we come back, we're going to talk about what this means for teens. We'll be right back after this. This is All of It from WNYC. I'm Kushan Avidar in for Allison Stewart, and we're talking to Dr. Sue Varma, who is a psychiatrist and clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at NYU Langone Health. We're talking about her new book, which is called Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being. We're talking about practical optimism. What impact could it have on your life? How do you adopt it if you're not already an optimistic person? And what's the difference between optimism and practical optimism? And listeners, we're taking your calls and your texts. Do you consider yourself more of an optimist or a pessimist? If so, why? What questions do you have for Dr. Varma? Give us a call or text us at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. And Dr. Varma, during the break, we got a bunch of texts all about young folks. I'm going to read one to you right now. Can your guest please talk about how parents can help their tweens and teens become more optimistic? So, Dr. Varma, how do you see this impact people who are on the younger side of life? And how can a young person, say, in their teens, start to think about incorporating practical optimism?
Yes. So this is where the muscle part comes in, and that it is a practice, and to never berate ourselves if we don't automatically tend to imagine best possible outcome in a situation, because that's what optimism is okay, something has happened, or in the face of uncertainty, like let's say a big test is coming up and someone's like, you know, I might fail. So first thing I would say is be aware of negative thinking. And, you know, in practical optimism, I talk about a variety of things that pessimistic people do, or not even just pessimistic people, but in a situation that has high stakes. For example, if you have a big exam coming in and it's an entrance exam or admissions test, you're trying to apply to college, for example, or you're a young adult applying to your first job, the negative thinking seeps in, I'm not going to get it, or you have a tendency to catastrophize or think of the worst case scenario. So being aware of your thoughts and then being able to recognize some of the thoughts as distortions, and this is coming from cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive distortions, and then being able to talk back to your thoughts and coming up and reframing, and this is comes out of the work of from trauma treatment, but in general, learning how to reframe a thought to say, okay, what would I tell a friend? We have a tendency to be kinder to our friends than we are to ourselves. And speaking of kindness, it's really important for children to adopt self-compassion. Mm-hmm. And we saw that kids, when let's say they failed a math exam, for example, they've done studies where they tell the student to do a quick self-compassion exercise where they have to think about their feelings, right, and label them, not getting overly invested. Okay, I'm feeling sad, I'm anxious, I'm angry. Simply to observe them, mindful observation of your feelings. That's the first step. The second step is to normalize what you're feeling. And the third step is to accept it. The last one is to come up with a path forward. And a lot of times people think self-compassion, that's woo-woo. Oh, you're letting people off the hook. They're not taking responsibility. And that's not the case at all. We find time after time, there's a lot of science, just that there is behind optimism, there's a lot of science behind self-compassion. And people who are more self-compassionate to themselves don't get mired in pessimism, negativity, shame and blame and guilt. And instead, they're able to let go. And then they're able to come up with a path forward. And those students ended up taking the test and did far better the second time as compared to students who did not do a self-compassion intervention and those who had done poorly. So self-compassion is really important for the kid. And also, I would say, is not engaging in comparisons. And it's so hard because, and you know, that's a whole topic for a whole other day about the role of social media and how it can be really damaging to a young person's self-esteem from a variety of perspectives, the comparisons, but also because it's taking time away. You know, most teens are on their phones or their devices all day long. Most adults are. But when it takes time away from sleep, from exercising, from connecting with friends in person, we know that most teens, high school students at least, are spending less than 40 minutes a day after school socializing with people. And then their friends often aren't a source of support, but rather competition if it comes to academics or sports or college admissions. So I feel like it's really important for parents to support their child's mental health in a variety of ways, with the sleep, with the meeting friends in person, nutrition, exercise, and also for the parents to be aware of their own mental health and how that can impact the teens and getting help for themselves early.
It sounds like there's a lot of steps that you can take to both give the child or teen agency and also create an environment in which they can flourish. Let's go to Harold in Manhattan. Hi, Harold. Welcome to the show.
Pam. Hi. Thank you for my call. Dr. Fascinating. Thank you. NYU graduate, 1975, studying psychology. I'm 70 years old. I've had a successful, brilliant career, social life, home building. I'm all viewed very much as a practical optimist. I always seem to succeed at what I've challenged myself with. 5 years ago, I lost my vision completely after slow vision loss due to HIV. That was a struggle in the 90s and 2000s. Now I am working toward maintaining my optimistic, successful approach to relationships, work, every aspect of my life that previously was successful. It kept me optimistic. I still feel optimistic, but the challenges are daunting, as you can imagine. And also trying to still appear to everyone else, which is a big part of keeping my personality optimistic. In other words, the outlook of others toward Harold saying, wow, Harold, even blind, is going to the gym and learning how to walk with a cane and other things like that, when I'm demonstrating those things but having a really hard time struggling to actually feel them.
Harold, thank you so much for that call, and we're wishing you the best. And Dr. Varma, I want to get to one word that I heard Harold say, which I think is key, and that's the word daunting. And there is a text that we just got that I think dovetails with this nicely. It reads, I practice optimism because fear and negativity take too much time. Perhaps more importantly, my experience is that the result of consciously choosing to be optimistic creates a bank account I can draw on. Sometimes that's really tough when things like Harold was saying were very daunting. So if there is one action item you would like to leave listeners with that would be a great kickstart for them to begin to adapt it, even in the face of things that are daunting, what would that one action item be?
It's beautiful. I would say put the cart before the horse. And sometimes if you're not feeling positive and you don't feel like doing something, but you know that it's good for you, just the way Harold is going to the gym and learning to walk with a cane, following up with behaviors that you know will give you return on your investment several fold, and continue to make those deposits into that bank account, that practical optimism bank account, even when you don't feel like it, because it will pay dividends exponentially.
And thank you to all the callers who took the time to share their stories and talk to us. We really appreciate it, and we're wishing everyone the best. We've been talking to Dr. Sue Varma, psychiatrist and clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at NYU Langone Health. Her book, Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Varma.
Thank you so much for having me. What a pleasure. Thank you.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.